Today we have a very topical subject in what I believe and have described previously as a network world, a very changing world where the existence of blocks is no longer the dominant criteria as to what influence you have, but your trading ability, your ability to prosper. And today our subject is British competitiveness, responding to the rise of the emerging powers, and I'm sure that our speaker will mention China. I have to say that every time I refer to China as an emerging power, they say to me, no, we are a re-emerging power, because we were here a long time before you were, which I think historically is correct. Today we're very lucky to have Jeremy Brown, the Minister of State at the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, who was appointed at the beginning of this coalition government. As Minister of State, he's responsible for the Far East and Southeast Asia, India, Nepal, Latin America, Australasia and the Pacific. Importantly, emerging powers coordination, and equally importantly at this time of this particular year, the Olympics. He is the Member of Parliament for Taunton Deane, where he was elected in May 2005. He's held various positions in the Liberal Democrat Party, but it is, as the Minister of State at the Foreign Office, with his particular interest in the subject of British competitiveness and the emerging nations. I ask him to address us now.
Well, Michael, thank you very much. I should say for clarification that when it said that I'm the Minister for the Olympics, I don't actually decide what time the 100 metres race takes place or anything as exciting as that. I have a more mundane task to do with protocol and diplomatic related functions to do with the Olympics. But thank you very much for giving me a chance to speak to you this afternoon. This is my third speech today. The first one was on Britain's relations with Latin America. The second was on Britain's relations with Uganda. Doesn't help that I've never been to Uganda, know very little about Uganda, but because the Africa minister is in Africa, I was pressed into service. So it's nice, having done those more specific speeches, to take on the whole world for the next half hour. And I'm very grateful to the Global Strategy Forum for giving me this opportunity. In the last year, Britain and the world, have been buffeted by international events. The Eurozone crisis, Libya, Syria, tensions over Iran, which exist still very strongly today. And these have captured our attention and required robust responses. But the subject today that I want to talk about are the developments which I believe, when we look back, or when people look back at the 21st century as a whole, these developments will be those that most strongly defined the times in which we currently live. While we worry rightly about the waves of daily events, we must always avoid failing to notice that the tide of world affairs is changing at the same time. So today, I want to explain why I believe that the world is transforming and that we will need to transform ourselves here in Britain if we are not to be left behind. We have many advantages that will stand us in good stead, but we must be beware of complacency. We have to change our mindset as a country. We are not prosperous and influential by right. We need to work hard to be successful in the future. We need to compete, and we need to do so on the world stage. When this coalition government came to power 2 years ago, we committed to reorientating Britain's foreign policy. We recognise that the global balance of power is fundamentally shifting from west to east and from north to south. But whereas some see this transformation as a threat, we realise that development in the emerging powers presents a huge opportunity, not only for the hundreds of millions of people who are being lifted out of poverty right around the world, but also for an economy like ours, which was built on free trade, inventiveness, and a spirit of adventure. However, this opportunity would require us to recalibrate our focus. In the Foreign Office, we are shifting our network east and south. We are creating 50 new jobs in our embassy and consulates in China, 30 new posts in India, and we are sending more diplomats to dynamic countries like Brazil and Indonesia. We are reopening embassies in Madagascar, Kyrgyzstan, El Salvador, and the Ivory Coast. We've just opened a new consulate in Brazil, and we are setting up new trade offices across India. Britain's diplomatic retreat from parts of the world like Latin America and Southeast Asia is over, and we have put prosperity at the heart of our activity. Ministers have travelled to every corner of the globe to promote Great Britain and all that we have to offer. And my portfolio, as a minister in the Foreign Office who covers the majority of the emerging powers, including China, India and Brazil, but also the other major growing forces on the world stage, countries like Mexico and India and South Korea and Colombia, my portfolio gives me the opportunity to have a leading role in this process. The profound changes in the global order are difficult to discern on a day-to-day basis. Incremental transformation is less spectacular than revolutionary transformation. But that does not mean that it is either slow or unspectacular. Anyone who visits, as I do on a very frequent basis, the emerging powers, has a sense that something dramatic, something amazing, is taking place in the world. I have visited Tamil Nadu and Andhra Pradesh, the engine rooms of India, and seen for myself the dynamism and entrepreneurial spirit which has been driving double-digit growth. I've been to Shanghai and Guangzhou and Chengdu, the powerhouses of China's transformation. I've seen how South Korea has gone from poverty to prosperity in less than two generations, and how Brazil has become the sixth biggest economy in the world. And I have become evangelical about how important this transformation is to the world's fortunes and to Britain's fortunes. We are by now familiar with comparisons of relative growth rates between Europe and many emerging powers. But we sometimes forget that thanks to the magic of compounded growth, variance in rates of economic progress magnify hugely over time. Britain's growth at present does not reflect our long-term potential. But say we return to growth of around 2.5%, which I think many people would regard as a reasonable estimate. On that basis, our economy, the British economy, would double in size every 29 years. Turkey, which according to the World Bank grew by 9% in 2010, would see its economy double in size in 8 years. The Chinese economy, which in 2010 grew by 10.4%, would on that basis double in size every 7 years. Singapore, which grew by 14.5% in 2010, would double in less than 6 years. So it's not just economic growth that is creating huge changes, but it is the rate of economic growth over a sustained period of time. And that economic growth is making the world a very different place. But demographic change is also having a huge impact. The world's population recently passed the 7 billion mark. According to the United Nations, we are likely to reach the 8 billion mark by just 2025. Of those extra billion people in the world, in only 13, 14 years, Asia will account for 600 million of them, Africa for 350 million of them, and Europe for only 2 million of those extra billion people. And demographic changes are also not just a guide to long-term trends. Of all the people in the world entering the labour market over the next 3 years, One in four, a quarter of them, will be Indian. So a revolution is underway, an economic revolution, a demographic revolution, and it is happening right now in front of our eyes. Now you might say, sitting in this well-appointed club in the centre of one of the great cities of the world, so what? What does that mean to me? No one expects the world to reach a static equilibrium. Of course, things are always going to be in a state of flux. It has always changed in the past, and we have done just fine. So why do we need to have particular concern or particular interest in the changes that I have just described? Well, it is true that we have done well as a country over many years. But we have done well because we have adapted, we have embraced change. And the case I make to you today is that we need to adapt as a country to this new reality that I have just described if we are to remain just fine in the future. We are going to have to reach out even more beyond our traditional partners in order to make our way in the world. Already, international institutions are changing to reflect the shift in the global order. Just a decade ago, the economic high table accommodated 8 heads of state, the G8. And 7 of those 8 were from North America and Europe. Japan represented all of the world at that head table outside North America and Europe. 2008, so just 4 years ago, was the first G20 heads of government meeting. And some of those represented, the Australians, the European Union, are very familiar to us. But the diversity of the rest, Indonesia, South Korea, Brazil, Mexico, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, South Africa, India, that diversity requires Britain to forge stronger new alliances beyond our more traditional partnerships. These are countries with which we now increasingly deal economically and politically. Over the next 30 years, the world economy is projected to grow from $60 trillion to $200 trillion in just 30 years. That is $140 trillion of new prosperity available to claim in about one generation. The opportunities for trade are enormous, and it is uncontroversial to suggest that we should seek to win as much of this prosperity for Britain as possible. But to take advantage of it, we need to compete and we need to engage. We need to build new links, new relationships, and new partnerships. Seeking opportunities in foreign lands to drive prosperity at home is not a new challenge for us in Britain. It is something that we have been doing for hundreds of years. Britain has long been a champion of free trade. We have long explored the world beyond our islands, and we have long adapted to the changes. That is how we got to our current position in the world. And while it is right to acknowledge the speed of development in the emerging powers, we should not forget the strong fundamental position which Britain enjoys. We have less than 1% of the world's population, but its 7th largest economy. Our language is the global language. We are the only country in the world with membership of the UN Security Council, NATO, the European Union, and the Commonwealth. That is a remarkable network of alliances and influence. Only the United States can rival Britain in terms of global thought leadership. We are home to 4 of the world's top 10 universities and claim the 2nd highest number of Nobel Prize winners. Our inventions and ideas have shaped humanity, and our global thinking reaches far beyond higher education. I would argue that with the Financial Times, The Economist, and the BBC, we have the most influential newspaper, the most influential current affairs periodical, and the most influential broadcaster anywhere in the world. That is not a result of luck or chance. London contains a richer array of academics, specialists, journalists, think tanks, and NGOs than any other city in the world. It is also the world's financial capital, sitting in between the Americas and Asia, and able to do business with both over the course of the day. Our capital boasts London Fashion Week, the Proms, Wimbledon Tennis, Premiership Football, the Royal Opera House, the British Museum, and of course the Olympic Games, which we are looking forward to showcasing the talents and energy that we have to offer at those games in July and August. The point is this: Britain is starting from a very strong position, which would be envied by the overwhelming majority of other countries in the world. We have the expertise to exploit new opportunities and continue to compete on the global stage. Britain kicked off the Industrial Revolution. We changed the world. But now, with the Emerging Powers Revolution, the world is changing, and Britain needs to change with it, because past success is never a reliable guide to future performance. So when most people think about the opportunities provided by the emerging powers, they think about trade. And they're right. But the question is Britain positioned to take advantage of these expanding markets around the world? We can compare the composition of our exports with the composition of exports from three European countries to which we might most easily compare ourselves: France, Germany, and Italy, what I call the EU3. We can compare ourselves to them. It's a good benchmark for Britain. If you scale each of these economies so that they match the UK's economic size, and then take an average of the three, you get a useful indicator of how we are getting on. And against this benchmark, the EU3 outperforms the UK in exporting goods by about 24%. Not only that, the EU3 benchmark exports about twice as much as us to China and Brazil, more than twice as much to Turkey, and almost three times as much as us to Russia. Most of our exports go to the so-called established markets, such as the other European countries, America, Japan, Australia. That explains the now well-rehearsed fact that we export more to Ireland than we do to the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India and China combined. I'm told, by the way, that that fact isn't actually true. But if you take Russia out, it is true that we export more to Ireland than Brazil, China and India combined, which is a remarkable statistic. The point remains valid. Britain needs to increase its trade with the fast-growing economies. We can't have so many of our eggs in the basket marked already emerged powers. Demand for exports like ours in the emerging powers is forecast to grow by far more over the next 5 years than it is in the established markets. In the Eurozone and the United States, this growth is likely to total around 40% in the Eurozone and 30% in the US. But in Brazil, growth is likely to be over 90%, India 100%, China over 120%, and Russia nearly 160%. So to answer whether our current reliance on established markets matters, we can go back to our EU3 benchmark. If Britain maintains its current market share in all markets around the world, if we maintain our current market share, by 2015, just by the end of this parliament, our exports will be worth $975 billion, 975. But if we did at least as well as the benchmark EU3 in all the emerging powers between now and 2015, our exports would be worth an extra $84 billion on top of what we might already expect. That's about 4% of our GDP. And if we did at least as well in all the emerging powers and the A12 European accession countries, if you like, the emerging Europe, our exports would be worth an extra $154 billion in 3 years' time, almost 7% of Britain's GDP. So does it matter that we export more to Ireland than we do to China, India and Brazil combined? Yes, it does matter. It makes a difference to the prosperity and well-being of millions of British people. I'm not arguing that we should be turning away from our traditional partners. They remain huge markets, and there is also massive scope for cooperation with them, as the European project has shown. In terms of exports, negotiating trade agreements with the collective weight of Europe can be hugely advantageous. Of course, that will not only benefit Britain, but despite my previous benchmarking against the E3, prosperity is never a zero-sum game. It is estimated that if successful, negotiation of an EU-Japan economic partnership agreement could benefit the United Kingdom by €5.8 billion a year. So the EU can help us to take advantage of growth in emerging powers. There are trade agreements on the table with India, Malaysia, Singapore, and many others. If all these deals were concluded, they could be worth as much as €90 billion to Europe's economy. And remember, as a trading bloc, Europe is the biggest, the largest in the world, with an economy and a population bigger even than the United States. We benefit hugely from our membership of the single market, but it is not complete yet. There are still restrictions in the digital and services markets that need to be addressed, and European regulation can be overbearing and burdensome to business. At its best, the European Union can enhance the prosperity of all its citizens. But at its most restrictive, it hampers our ability to compete with the fast-growing economies. And that is why Britain is right to always argue for a confident, outward-looking, free-trading Europe. Our membership of the European Union makes Britain additionally attractive as the destination for inward investment. The UK is a springboard into the largest single market in the world. More overseas companies set up their European headquarters in the United Kingdom than anywhere else in Europe. So we have causes for optimism, but not for complacency. We cannot expect foreign companies to invest in the UK simply because of our access to Europe, or because their CEO was educated at the London School of Economics, or because the lure of corporate hospitality at Arsenal Football Club. We are competing with other countries for investment, and we need to make the business climate in the UK as attractive as possible for the people who are making those investments. And that is why the recent budget was so focused on increasing global competitiveness. This government, our government, is cutting corporation tax down to 22% by 2014, so that we will have the most competitive tax system for business of all the established major economies. We are committed to personal tax rates that are globally competitive. We are cutting income tax to increase the incentive to work for 23 million Britons. And we are addressing the inadequacies of our physical infrastructure. We are determined to ensure that we have some of the fastest broadband speeds in Europe. We are improving our train connections, upgrading the underground, tackling motorway bottlenecks, and refurbishing our airport terminals. The government is reviewing our aviation needs and building a new high-speed rail connection between our great cities of London, Birmingham, and Manchester. Being globally competitive on both taxation and on infrastructure is vital to Britain's future prosperity. So there are steps that we can take and that we are taking to make the UK an attractive place for investment. But these will not automatically make our businesses more successful abroad, more successful at selling things, making more successful investments themselves, and making more successful partnerships. What that requires, that success, is a mindset in our businesses and in Britain. Britain achieved greatness by being outward-looking, bold and inventive. Our greatness was built on free trade, innovation, adventure and hard work. We continue to benefit from our historical relationships with countries around the globe, and we have a diverse and cosmopolitan population. To succeed today and in the future, we must have the mindset which enabled Britain to succeed before. The world is different, but the benefits of being outward-looking, bold and inventive remain the same as ever. We will never prosper by becoming more inward-looking and parochial. In a survey done by Chatham House and the polling organisation YouGov, polling suggested that the general public had little interest in the UK strengthening its relationship with the emerging powers. Of those asked, only 18%, 1/8, thought we should strengthen relations with Brazil, 19% with India, and 20% with Russia. The number of people who thought that we should weaken our relations with Turkey and Indonesia outnumbered those who thought we should strengthen our relationships with them by a ratio of more than 2-1. But turning our backs on the world, just as globalisation becomes an everyday reality, would be a catastrophic historical mistake. Let me put it this way. My guess is that most British people could not name the capital of Indonesia, and they may not know that it is the fourth most populous country on earth with a stable democracy. And yet on the streets of Jakarta, the capital of Indonesia, if any of you were wondering, on the streets of Jakarta you will find people shopping in Debenhams, Topman, Miss Selfridge, Karen Millen and Dorothy Perkins. It is this engagement and more of it that is essential to our success, and that is why our Prime Minister's visit to Indonesia and other booming Asian economies earlier this month was so important and so well-timed. And last October, there was a piece on the Times Higher Education website about another YouGov poll suggesting that 1 in 10 British students had no interest in going overseas to work, volunteer, or even just to visit. 1 in 10 had no interest. The most recent comment, if you go on that website, says this. It says, 1 in 10 is fewer than I thought. I would have guessed something like 7 in 10. Who needs the world when there's Great Britain? Well, I'm delighted that people are so proud of our country, but I disagree with the sentiment. And this attitude is reflected in the percentage of children learning foreign languages in our schools. In 2001, so we're only talking a decade ago, 75% of students at state comprehensives took a foreign language at GCSE, 3/4. In 2010, only 40% of students took a GCSE foreign language. Perhaps if more young people learned a foreign language, then more than 1 in every 50 British students would study abroad, which is currently the case, just 2%. I want young people to grasp the exciting opportunities that exist in the world. I want us to be the most outward-looking country on the planet. The competitiveness of our education and the opportunities for young people will be a key factor in determining Britain's future success. We have world-famous universities and some world-famous schools, but our educational competitiveness has been falling and levels of educational failure in the country are unacceptable. Being 20th in literacy and 22nd in numeracy in the OECD world rankings of 15-year-olds is an underperformance. We pride ourselves on being highly educated, high-skilled, a dynamic workforce, but to be a knowledge economy, we have to be a highly knowledgeable country. And in the same OECD rankings, South Korea came out top of the table in both literacy and numeracy. Poland came above us in both fields as well. So we should not be surprised that some people in our labour market are struggling to compete with immigrants from elsewhere in Europe. The answer is not to pull up the drawbridge and pretend that we can isolate ourselves from the outside world, whether it's Poland or whether it's South Korea, the answer is to raise our game and compete more effectively. We need to build strong foundations for the future by improving our education system, as our government is doing. We need to ensure that hard work is rewarded, as our government is doing. We need to make it easier to employ people, as our government is doing. We need to enable companies to flourish, as our government is doing. And it is essential that Britain tackles its budget deficit and puts our economy on a sustainable footing. Until we eliminate our deficit, our debt and the interest we pay on it will continue to rise. We have seen the impact of runaway debt on some of our European neighbours. We, in Britain, spend more paying the interest on our government debts each year than we do on education, despite the performance deficit that I have just outlined. So this coalition government remains adamant that our deficit must be reduced, and it remains the central priority of this government. The changing economics of the world will also affect the world's politics. We will find ourselves interacting more and more with countries that do not currently hold all the same values as we do. We could come under increasing pressure to compromise our commitment to equality, our respect for human rights, our sanctification of the freedoms that allow each of us to pursue our own conceptions of the good. But we will stay true to ourselves, not only because I believe that we have a moral obligation to uphold universal human rights, but because in the long run, liberal values will make the world a safer and more prosperous place. At the recent BRICS summit, it was widely observed that the states spoke in terms of managing differences as opposed to finding and protecting common values, which they considered to be Eurocentric. But human rights are not just Western preoccupations. To be on the side of personal freedom is to be on the right side of history. The Arab Spring graphically illustrated that people from all corners of the globe aspire to the rights and freedoms that we espouse. They are universal. And as economies develop around the world, they will need the innovation, entrepreneurship and private sector growth that come from having individual freedoms protected by the rule of law. They will realise that economic growth can create societal tensions that require the pressure valves of civil and political rights. Promoting and protecting human rights is not just true to our values, it is essential to ensuring that the new world order which we are moving towards is safe and prosperous for us and for our neighbours. And it is not a challenge that we face alone. The European Union can be a massive force for improving human rights standards across the globe, as well as being the world's largest trading bloc. It is also the world's largest aid donor. Collectively, we have a powerful ability to be a force for good. So let me sum up. The world is going through profound change. Our success in the past was based on our ability to adapt. We are starting today from a position of strength, but we must adapt again and do so comprehensively. We must invest in our future, in our children's education and in our physical infrastructure. We must create space for businesses to thrive and the incentives for people to work hard. We must compete with the other major economies for investment from abroad. We must reinvigorate our outlook, recapturing the spirit of the great British explorers, intent on chartering new waters and uncovering new opportunities. But at the same time, we must stand by our values, our commitment to universal freedoms and human rights. These will underpin our long-term security and prosperity. Change is not optional. It is essential. Stagnation and complacency would be a recipe for decline. Only by embracing change will we be able to benefit from the rise of the emerging powers and secure our future prosperity as well.